Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Defending ocean resources, conservationists are hailing a recent win in court that blocks commercial fishing in a protected Pacific area. Decades of data collection on Mauna Loa teeters on the edge of a fiscal cliff. We hear the cackling call of an introduced game bird on this week's Manu Minute. And Hawaii has some of the lowest divorce rates in the nation, but couples who call it quits are often representing themselves in court. We take a closer look at the process. And we learn about an innovative program in our criminal justice system to keep girls out of prison. Other states are taking note. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Ocean protection. Earth Justice recently won a round in federal court. On Friday, Hawaii District Court Judge Micah Smith ruled that President Donald Trump's executive order to allow commercial fishing in a protected area was invalid. It remains to be seen if the administration will appeal the decision. Earth Justice represents three nonprofits in the lawsuit: Kapa'a, the Conservation Council for Hawaii, and the Center for Biological Diversity. We talked to Saul Kaho'o Halahala yesterday. He's with the group Kapa'a and is chair of the Pacific Islands Heritage Coalition. The former state representative and director of the Kohoʻolawe Island Reserve Commission recently returned from a United Nations Oceans Conference. He is headed to another UN gathering at the end of this week. We talked to him about the latest ruling. What was your reaction when you heard the news?
For me, I'm very pleased that we were able to at least continue to have standing in the court as a client, and that this judge was very expedient in making sure that he was asking the administration the right questions about their decisions, and then coming out with a decision that says that the letter that was submitted by the National Marine for Fisheries, which cancels all previous protections, is not valid. And by the Trump's administration opening up these areas for commercial fishing, of which we've worked really hard for decades to protect, is now deemed to be invalid. So the administration's letter is deemed by the courts to be invalid. Therefore, it does not allow commercial fisheries to go into the area of the Pacific Island Heritage National Marine Monument to begin commercial fishing, as has been the executive order stated by the president. So for us, that is a step in the right direction, because it just now puts at bay these activities, which are going to be so detrimental to the work that we have been doing for decades in terms of trying to set aside protected areas and their resources for generations to come. And so this executive order, to me, was quite irresponsible on the part of the administration to just come with this idea that the U.S. wants to become the greatest and the biggest and the largest marine commercial fisheries area in the world, and in the same moment, not give any consideration to what it is that we have had a vision for, and that's the protection of these resources that would be available for the generations of children yet unborn. So for us, putting a halt on this at this juncture is a major win, because it keeps the ocean in the pristine and protected condition of which we had intended.
And talk about the organization that you're with, because most folks know you as a lawmaker, a former lawmaker.
Yes.
But talk about the mission of this organization that you belong to now.
Yes, so I belong to the Pacific Island Heritage Coalition. And so we are a membership of different expertise. We have marine scientists. We have cultural communities. We have people who are very astute in law, and collectively what we've been trying to do was be very responsible in responding to all of the kinds of challenges that come especially in the pushback to create marine protected areas. So we have been subject of a lot of criticism by the commercial fisheries for having to create these protected areas and told that we would be killing the fishing community and creating havoc and people not being able to have jobs and all. So the coalition was, in our work, is trying to make sure that we were very responsible. So we made sure that we covered all of those bases so that we were clear about our position to create protection and that it was never our intent to create a position of which we were going to create havoc for the fisheries or the people involved in fisheries. And so we have been successful in demonstrating our intent. And so I have to give credit to this coalition. We are the Protect PIH or Pacific Island Heritage.org. And this is where we have brought all of the information that people who want to become informed about our work as a coalition. So protectpih.org is available for anyone to look at, and it'll help you to have an update on where it is we are. Even these current legal issues have been posted there for access to anyone in the general community to be informed.
We did talk to the Fisheries Council, Kitty Simons, mm-hmm. and the president signed this executive order. And yep. I know that they were saying that the Samoan fisheries was not in good shape and that they were hoping that the executive order would help bolster that industry there. So what do you say to the concerns that they have about access?
Like I said, we have been doing our own due diligence in terms of the Samoan tuna cannery industry. And what we understand is that the American Samoan tuna cannery industry is not going to be affected by our protection. What is a critical concern for the tuna industry in American Samoa is that the processing of the fish that they normally would bring into American Samoa is being determined by the fisheries themselves, and many of them are deciding that they can process their tuna in other locations than American Samoa at a more economical cost. So trying to bring their catch all the way to American Samoa for processing becomes a problem, not because of our protection, but because of the economics of that. And that's what we have been trying to help American Samoa to come to some term in understanding how can we help American Samoa, who is now being threatened with losing their tuna canneries because of the fact that tuna is being shipped elsewhere. But they keep hanging on to that and saying that it is the marine protection that is impacting the tuna cannery industry. And we beg to difference because we've examined this and we find it not that the protection is creating the problem, it's the economics that's creating their problem.
And Saul, you are headed to the United Nations for meetings in the next couple of weeks about ocean protection. So share with our listeners what that's all about. Because you were at an oceans conference earlier this summer.
Correct. So the United Nations Ocean Conference was held in Nice, and that was for the first time bringing to a head, especially in these critical times of climate change and climate crisis, the ocean is becoming the place of which we need to be more mindful in where and how we move forward. So that was an important gathering for the ocean. This next meeting is the result of a treaty that was signed in December of 2023 at the United Nations, and it's called the Treaty of the High Seas and looking at protection beyond national jurisdiction. So what has been determined by science is that 30% of the land and sea needs to be protected if the global Earth is intending to continue extracting at the rate we are currently extracting. So this new treaty, signed in December 2023, is called the BBNJ Treaty. It stands for Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction. It's intended now to look at protected areas that will meet the 30% requirement by the global oceans for protection if we want to be sustained. And so that is very critical for us because these are the oceans that are just beyond the 200-mile jurisdiction of all countries. And this has been deemed as the high seas, and it has also been deemed as a place that is owned by no one country. So we consider the high seas as the global seas and the commons for humankind. And therefore, this initiative now is to create the language that will put into force this treaty. And so I will be attending this meeting for the next 2 weeks. And in order for me to make sure that our indigenous participation and inclusion are created in the language that is being created to put this treaty into force at the front end. Too often, as we have experienced in deep sea mining, that treaty has been passed 30 years ago. And for me, even though I'm trying to make inroads on how to change the language of a treaty to incorporate our inclusion as indigenous people who have an interest in deep sea and the mining issues of deep sea. But here is one that's talking about the ocean or the vertical water column above the seabed. And therefore, it's saying that we need to find protection in this area of ocean moving forward. And we need to achieve at a minimum 30% protection of the global oceans in the high seas. And I would like to make sure that our participation as the people from Oceania are included in this treaty from the beginning. And therefore, it will never be an opportunity where we have to struggle to raise our voices or to become included. So I'm saying we no longer want to be acknowledged as indigenous people and have interest in the ocean, but we want to be included, integrated, and incorporated into the language of the treaty so that we are there to make policy decisions along with other nation states around the world.
Yes, you want to be included at the table.
Yes.
I'm flashing back to the FESPAC that we had here in Honolulu and a remark that I heard from one of the leaders of the Pacific Island Nations. And he said, we are not just inhabitants of these tiny islands. We are protectors of the world's largest ocean. I'll always remember that. The kuleana, the responsibility.
Absolutely. And for us in Hawaii, we have a genealogy of Mo'okua'ahao, the Kumulipo, which states that we begin from the deep sea. So we have that foundation as well to add to this discussion.
Well, thank you so much for your time and safe travels as you head over to the continent.
Okay. Thank you very much. Aloha.
That was former lawmaker and environmental advocate Saul Kaho'ohalahalo talking to us about the recent court ruling on commercial fishing in the Pacific Islands Heritage Marine National Monument. The Western Pacific Regional Fisheries Management Council said in a statement that they were disappointed by the decision and they plan to discuss its options at a meeting next month. An observatory atop Mauna Loa is on the edge. Its federal funding is in danger of being cut, which could mean the end of atmospheric research after close to 70 years. HBR Savannah Harriman Pote takes us into a laboratory to talk to a scientist whose fight to keep operating is personal. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, I'm jealous. You really got to talk to some key people involved in that research.
I absolutely did. So this is a laboratory actually in San Diego. It's at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, but it's been working in partnership with the Mauna Loa Observatory for many, many decades. And what these two institutions do together is they measure the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so I wanted to understand how these measurements work because they are a really important lens into how human-driven emissions are changing the climate. So I actually had the opportunity to go to the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and the Keeling Lab, which is where this research takes place. And research specialist Tim Luker gave me kind of a crash course. So to set the scene when I get there, The lab is full of these big glass circular flasks that are full of air, and that air is captured on Mauna Loa as well as a few other Hawaii Island locations. And then these glass, like volleyballs essentially, are shipped across the Pacific to the Keeling lab. In the lab, there's also these huge tanks of liquid nitrogen. And so Luker showed me a very simplified version of their process by dipping a slim tube of captured air into a small vat of liquid nitrogen, which caused the carbon dioxide in the tube to turn into a solid for a moment.
You have to look fast because see the white dots? So that's frozen CO2 that came out of one of these big volleyball-sized flasks. That's all that is. That little bit of carbon dioxide is what's going to change the climate on Earth for hundreds of years.
Oh, I love the chemistry of it all.
It's really interesting, right? And it's hard to think that, as you said, that little bit of carbon dioxide has such a big impact. But carbon dioxide is a tiny fraction of the Earth's atmosphere and also a very potent greenhouse gas. So even small increases can have an effect on climate. And what the Keeling Lab has done over the last 6 decades is document a yearly increase in global carbon dioxide levels. And that data set is called the Keeling Curve because it's named after the scientist Charles David Keeling, who started this work. And when you look at it, you see that the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has risen nearly every year since 1958 when they started taking the measurements, creating this really distinct upward curve. And again, that is a lens into understanding how humans are changing the climate, and its significance really derives from its consistency over such a large period of time.
Yes, I mean, this is just good basic science, right, for this lab?
Absolutely. And it's really due to the work of Charles David Keeling, who has devoted his life to this record. He meticulously kept up this data set from 1958 until his death in 2005. But it's important to know that there are really two Keelings who should get credit for the Keeling Curve, because when Charles David Keeling died, his son Ralph, who is also conveniently an atmospheric scientist, stepped in to keep the work going. So Ralph Keeling had worked alongside his father at Scripps for a number of years, but he said his father never set the expectation that his son would follow in his footsteps in this way. Ralph actually called him the, quote, opposite of a helicopter parent. But apparently, Charles David Keeling was getting pressure from one of his funders to show that he had a succession plan.
You're getting old, Dave. Who's going to take over? And so he persuaded me to join him as a co-investigator on his grants. I didn't immediately have any responsibility. I was already kind of knowledgeable enough to serve that role, but it helped his proposal that I was on them. And then he suddenly died of a heart attack. And I found myself as the principal on these projects he was leading. So I immediately had responsibility for everything he was doing. And I had to decide, okay, what am I going to do with this? Am I going to shut this down? Am I going to keep it going? Because it hadn't really been mine in fullness until that point. And so it fell on me, and I couldn't bring myself to shut it down because it seemed like it was too important. And it was the same dilemma he faced his whole career, is that there are all these exciting, important things you could do, but just keeping this record going is probably more important than any of those things. So there's a special responsibility you have if you find yourself in that unique position. And I found myself like he had in that position.
I just love this, the family legacy.
Yeah, it's really become something of a family business. And Ralph watched his father devote his life to this data set, and he himself has worked to maintain this data set for the last 20 years. And just to put this data in the context of Ralph's life, right? Since 1958, global carbon dioxide levels have risen about 36%. That's pretty much the timeline of Ralph's life, because he can tell how much time has passed looking at the curve, which is nearly the same age he is.
So the record started a year after I was born. But a few months later, there was a peak. So that first peak, I was one. The second peak, I was 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 68.
Wow. So this is, in some ways, not just a timeline of your father's work and your work, but of your life.
Yeah. I mean, let me say that I've watched this curve over time, and it keeps changing. And it keeps changing because the wiggles get smaller and smaller relative to the rise. It's like each year is less significant to my overall lifespan.
Because you're zooming out, more years are on this x-axis here.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
How does that feel?
Makes me feel old.
Oh, I can relate. I love that. But what's the plan for the Keeling Lab if the Mauna Loa Observatory shuts down?
Right, right. So you need very specific conditions in order to take these measurements, basically. You need no interference of other carbon dioxide sources like cars. Researchers even hold their breath sometimes when they're capturing air. But there are other places where the instruments that are currently at Mauna Loa could be set up. One is really close by. So when Mauna Loa erupted in 2022, researchers lost access to the observatory, and access remains really limited. So in order to keep data collection going, Keeling and his colleagues actually jerry-rigged some equipment on Mauna Kea, and those instruments are actually still collecting data. So that's an option. And when you look at the curve, you'll see a little note on it that says Mauna Kea data. But both Ralph Keeling, he really believes that the data collection should continue at Mauna Loa the way that his father has always done it. And that's not just for sentimental reasons, but also for scientific ones. The value of that data, again, is in its consistency, which could become more important as climate becomes more volatile. So one of the things that they've observed just in the last year and a half is record growth in carbon dioxide levels. And they're able to put that data into context and ask, okay, why is this happening now? Because they have 70 years of data to serve as such a consistent benchmark.
Yeah, that is truly remarkable. But what's the latest on the funding?
Yes. So Congress is reviewing the proposal by the Trump administration to cut funding to the Mauna Loa Observatory, as well as several other hubs in the county's greenhouse gas monitoring network, not just the Mauna Loa Observatory. So far, U.S. lawmakers have kept NOAA's budget largely intact. So that's good news for Keeling and his colleagues. And, you know, this isn't the first time that the Mauna Loa Observatory has faced a budget shortfall. In 1963, just 5 years after the Keeling record started, federal funding cuts nearly shut that station down. And there have been plenty of lean times since. But what Ralph Keeling says feels different about this time is it's not just NOAA that's facing cuts. It's also the National Science Foundation and NASA. He says there's no safety net for science that's occurring at this level.
Yeah, it would be tragic if that, you know, database, right, were just to go away after all these decades.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Savannah. Really appreciate the story.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HBR Climate and Energy reporter Savannah Harriman-Pope talking to us about the unknown future for the Mauna Loa Observatory, whose funds could be cut. It would mean an end to decades of data collection for atmospheric research.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Mauna, offering master programs in finance, information systems, marketing, and travel industry management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
You know, in this week's Mono Minute, we hear the song of a bird in the partridge family, one called Urkel's Spurfowl or Urkel's Franklin. But if you ask us, the song is really more of a cackle. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo biology professor Patrick Hart.
Urkel's Franklins are plump, partridge-like birds with a distinctive chestnut-colored cap on their head and chestnut-streaked feathers on their chest and back. They're about 16 inches long and weigh a little more than 2 pounds. Originally from the Ethiopia region of Africa, Hawaii is the only other place in the world they're found in the wild, as they were introduced as a game bird here in the 1950s to 60s. They can be seen on Oahu, Kauai, and the Big Island, where they've become very common, especially in higher elevation grasslands and shrublands. If you hear a loud laughing cackle, but there's no people around, there's a good chance there's an Urkel's Franklin nearby. Urkel's Franklins are similar to chickens in that they spend most of their time on the ground and also prefer to run rather than fly. Also like chickens, the females lay a large clutch of eggs in a nest on the ground, and when the young hatch, they're already covered with feathers and are ready to forage on their own. A recent study from Oahu showed that they love to consume a variety of fruits from both native and non-native plant species, and are likely spreading a variety of invasive plants such as vivee, blackberry, and clydemia into our native forests. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering guided nature adventures on Hawaii Island, designed to help inspire connection and stewardship of the land. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
Hawaii has one of the lowest divorce rates in the country. But for those who go through the process, it's not pretty. And in more than 60% of the cases, neither party has a lawyer. And in more than 90% of the cases, at least one party isn't represented. This can make a difficult process even more challenging. That is why Bill Dara began the Divorce Law in Hawaii seminar back in 2002. Over the past 23 years, the program has steered thousands away from litigation and towards mediation. Hawaii Chief Justice Mark Reckenwald recently recognized the success of a program with a proclamation celebrating the 300th seminar. Dara leads each of the sessions with Tracy Wiltkin, who is the executive director of the Mediation Center of the Pacific. They spoke with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson. Wiltkin begins.
Most people going through divorce have no idea how the divorce process works, what they need to do, and how to navigate the court system. Because unfortunately, when two people realize they don't belong together anymore, the next step is going through our legal system, which can be very intimidating and scary. So the idea behind divorce law in Hawaii is to give couples the basics, to help them understand what forms they need, how the process works, and why they should consider mediation to work through their issues so that they can make this whole process less intimidating and non-adversarial.
Tell us where the idea came from, Bill, and how long ago you started it.
The program began in 2002. I'd been practicing as a family law attorney for about 25 years. I'd been a litigator the whole time. But I'd also learned how to use mediators to secure better, quicker outcomes for my clients. We decided that we would start a monthly presentation giving folks the tools they needed to understand their options and make responsible choices. I am struck to look back and see how well it's done.
Tracy, Bill mentioned that a lot of people go through the process without representation. Some of those numbers are kind of shocking. Share those with our listeners.
The numbers of people that go through without representation is huge. About 62% of all cases don't have representation. And, you know, when you think about it, I mean, going through a divorce, it's an emotional, difficult time. You are in love, and for whatever reason, you're not going to be together anymore. And many couples have children, so it's painful all the way around. Oftentimes, one person is the person ready to move forward and the other one isn't. And it's going to be financially challenging. So they don't want to spend more money on attorneys. Sometimes they can't afford attorneys. Sometimes it's just too scary. And yet they are navigating a process that is going to have huge impacts on the rest of their lives and their children's lives. So having an understanding of how to navigate the process and the system and how to best work through it is huge for them. And when they don't have that, oftentimes they don't follow through, maybe because they're scared. The fighting continues, which is the worst possible thing for them and the worst possible thing for their children.
Yeah, I think you really hit at the center of things there when you describe this sort of transition between an emotional experience, falling in love, and what needs to be a very practical experience, right? Mm-hmm. Finding out what the future looks like. That's the transition that a lot of people struggle with.
Exactly. That's exactly right. You fall in love and you get married. Why is it that you end up in court fighting with each other when you realize you're not going to be together anymore? And so having more information about how to move through that without fighting, without being in court, is really, really important.
Bill, what are some of the aspects of the divorce process that you think most commonly catch participants off guard?
That's a great question. I think many people, when confronted with such a difficult situation, jump to conclusion without sufficient information as to what their options might be. And I think the greatest thing that mediation can do is to help people get the information that they need to understand what their options are before they start fighting with each other. I saw in litigation that there was really quite a bit of time and money wasted in an effort to acquire the information that people needed to understand what their options were. And to me, that's the greatest benefit of mediation, its ability to accelerate the information gathering process. But yeah, the emotionality of it is huge. People need to be heard. And as Tracy often says, they need to be empowered. People are very fearful of the loss of control at this time. They don't know what's going to happen in the future, and they've suffered a grievous loss. All of them have, really.
Yeah, and that idea of information, I think, might even extend to not just information about the person that you're separating your life from and facts about items that you might want to keep control over in terms of children and pets and houses and all that, but information about the court system itself, right? And this is very localized. Even if someone might have experienced divorce in another state or had friends or family that did, it redounds to the state, right? It redounds to understanding how divorce is done in Hawaii.
That's exactly right. You know, every month we have 30 or more people participate in this program. Originally, when Bill started the program and then I got involved, it was in person. So we would be at the Supreme Court, and then we expanded it to Kapolei. But it's in the middle of the day, and it wasn't always accessible for people. And when COVID happened, we immediately moved it to Zoom and suddenly became accessible. I mean, we have people in their cars, they're in their yards, they're in their offices, but they can jump on and easily get this information that they need. And it's eye-opening for them because they don't have this information and they're going through this difficult time, and suddenly they have answers to their questions. They understand how this process is going to work and what they need to do. And you can see the relief on their faces, and even in the comments at the end that they put in the chat, you know that, okay, now they have some direction, they have an understanding, and they know how to move forward.
You're right about the fact that the law in Hawaii is different than the law pretty much any place else. The law in Hawaii is very helpful to a divorcing couple, quite honestly, because in Hawaii, we have a standard formula for dividing property and debt. And we have child support guidelines. They both describe presumptively correct outcomes. At a trial, a judge could decide any number of reasons to go with a non-formula outcome or non-guideline support, but they might not have enough time to hear all of the evidence as to why that would be appropriate On the other hand, in a mediation, the couple can pretty quickly come to an understanding as to what's the formula slash guideline outcome, and then have as much time as they want to come up with something that works better for them.
Yeah, and your point about time is really well taken. I would imagine this might not be something that occurs to most people going through this process, but a judge dealing with a crowded docket is going to be inclined to review information as quickly as he or she can. In a mediation, you can talk for as long as you need to, theoretically, to reach a good place.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So one of the things that we always tell people going through a divorce, you can feel powerless. Your life is out of control. You don't know what the future holds. But going through mediation gives you some control and power over your life and the decisions you're making, because exactly what you said, court, you're going to be there when they tell you to be there, and there's limited amount of time. Not that the family court judges aren't the most caring judges and they want to make good decisions, but it's a very busy court. And so people aren't going to have forever to talk. Whereas in mediation, you decide how much time you need, how much time you need to be heard, that you feel that you understand each other, that you can think about decisions that you're making, and most importantly, in mediation, that you are making those decisions, not a judge. And there was one family court judge who always said, I don't know your children and I don't love your children, but if you want me to, I'm going to make decisions about your children. And isn't it better that you, who love your children and know your children better than anybody else, make those decisions? And that's what you do in mediation. Going through this program also gives people the opportunity to start thinking about what is the best way to move forward, because Hawaii were unique. I mean, the cost of living is so high, oftentimes one or both of them are thinking about moving away. So then the decision becomes, should we get divorced here? Should we wait and do it there? And so hearing about the differences and the power of going through mediation and making choices for yourself after you have the information you need really helps couples start coming up with a plan and a way to move forward that, again, gives them control and power over their life when they're going through such a difficult time.
Bill, you've interacted with people during perhaps, as Tracy just said, one of the most difficult events in their life. What's it like to work in such close proximity to such a challenging process? What is that experience like?
I mean, there's been discussion of this concept of secondary trauma. I represented folks for over 40 years in what was for them the most important contest, let's say, of their lives. And you can't do that with commitment without feeling the impact of the losses. These people are really hurting, and the fights are not satisfying.
Tracy, similar question to you. What's it like to work in such close proximity to such a challenging process? Have you learned anything about divorce from all your years of working?
Absolutely. That's a great question. People are in pain, and they're angry, and they're hurt. And when we're emotional, we're not rational, and that's when we do stupid things. We resort to hurting each other more, not letting go of pain and emotion that isn't helpful. Fighting through the court process only makes it more painful. One day I saw a license plate, and the license plate said capital I, H, number 8, M, Y, X. So I hate my ex. And I thought, wow, that's somebody who never let it go, who must be still angry, still hurting, to drive around with that. And so what I've learned is when people can be heard and be able to bring those emotions down and be able to take control and make decisions together to move forward, it's so much more powerful. You know, it's not that we're advocating to get divorced, but people get divorced. And so if we can make it in a less painful way, watching people and engaging with people's lives is difficult, but when you see them work through it, it's really powerful. And that's the part that you know this is a good process and this is a good thing, and it is making a difference in people's lives and empowering them to make a difference in their children's lives.
That was Bill Dara and Tracy Wilkin talking with HPR's D.W. Gibson about the divorce law in Hawaii seminar program. It recently hit a milestone of 300 seminars. The next one-hour seminar will be held on August 20th, and both Dara and Wilkins make themselves available after the seminar to answer questions from attendees. For more information and a link to sign up, visit our website.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Next month is Classical Music Month, and HPR is counting down your top 100 compositions. Make sure your favorites are in the running. Tell us your top composers and classical music pieces. Voting ends August 31st. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/classicalmonth.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, offering classes in painting, printmaking, ceramics, and more for all ages and abilities. Registration for fall semester opens August 20th, honolulumuseum.org.
Hawaii reached a milestone in its prison system several years ago that received praise around the nation. No girls incarcerated in the state's youth correctional facility. Yep, that's right. The headcount was zero. It was a result of an innovative program called Girls Court, created by retired Judge Karen Radius. And now, states including California and New York are taking note. The nonprofit progressive magazine Mother Jones features a story about Girls Court in its August issue. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with senior reporter Samantha Michaels about her story.
A few years ago, I was just scrolling on Twitter and I saw an announcement by officials in Hawaii that the state's only youth prison no longer had any girls incarcerated there. And the post had gone viral because, you know, it was a good news story. And in criminal justice reporting, there's not a lot of good news most of the time. When I saw this announcement in Hawaii that they were no longer incarcerating girls, I was really intrigued and wanted to learn more about a place that was actually making the system better for girls and women. And so I decided to spend some time looking into it and try to figure out how Hawaii had achieved this milestone, and hopefully try to figure out whether like other places could do something similar. What I learned is that, you know, one of the ways that Hawaii reduced the incarceration of girls was through this innovative program called Girls Court. It was created about two decades ago by a judge, Judge Karen Radius. And at the time, there weren't really a lot of programs in the juvenile justice system that were focused on girls. Most of the programs were focused on boys. And so Judge Radius decided that she wanted to get a sense of what girls actually needed to stay out of incarceration. And so she and her team basically started asking girls who came before the court, which was pretty unusual. Normally, a judge just makes a decision, oh, you know, this child is struggling and they need substance abuse treatment or they need counseling, or, you know, the judge decides. And with Girls Court, the girls were paired with probation officers who worked more like social workers in some ways. And they would sit down with the girls and their families and they would get to know the girls and they would ask them, what is going on in your life? Why did you act out or get into trouble? And so the whole focus of the court was providing girls with the resources that they said that they needed. So maybe connecting them with housing or with substance abuse treatment or with healthcare, or maybe helping them with their relationships with their families or with relationships at school. So really trying to pinpoint what the root causes were for why a girl was acting out, and then helping her get the resources to heal and sort of overcome some of those root causes.
And you met with Judge Radius, you spoke with current social workers in that program and also young women who have gone through that program. Were there any stories or narratives that really struck you?
Yeah, I spent some time with a young woman named Cherish Kapika. She's 24 years old now, so she graduated from Girls Court a few years ago. But when she was a teenager, she was in and out of the justice system, especially for running away and status offenses. So status offenses are offenses that are only illegal because of your young age. So things like running away, truancy, missing your curfew. So she kept getting in trouble for these things. And they finally referred her to Girls Court, and she got connected with a probation officer named Tia. Over time, as they, you know, got to know each other, Tia learned that Cherish had a really hard upbringing. She had been neglected as a child. Her parents had struggled with addiction, so she was adopted. She was really struggling in school and wanted more help in school. She had fetal alcohol syndrome. And so, you know, the court connected her with an alternative school. The court also started working with her and her family. She had a hard time sometimes communicating with her uncle who had adopted her. So they started improving some of those relationships. They wanted to help improve her confidence. So they, you know, signed her up for surfing lessons, which she really enjoyed. And over the course of a few years in this program, she wasn't running away as much. She wasn't getting in trouble as much. She graduated from the program. She got a job at a bank and, you know, was thinking about college and really had turned herself around.
And in your reporting, you found that it's not just Hawaii that has programs like this. You mentioned other initiatives in, I believe, New York and California. So whether this is part of a trend or just one-offs?
So I would say in the juvenile justice system, a lot of the focus is still around boys. So programs like this are, they're not super common, but they're starting to grow. There are starting to be more of these programs. So Hawaii is interesting because Hawaii was one of the first states to try something like this. You know, back in 2004, this court was created. So Hawaii was in some ways a pioneer. But yeah, there are some other places that have similar programs. In California, in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's an organization called the Young Women's Freedom Center. In New York City, there's a program called ROSES. And these programs have been very successful as well. In parts of California that have relied on the Young Women's Freedom Center, they've also gone long stretches without girls in incarceration. In New York City, I think there was about a year in 2021, 2022, when there also were between 0 and 2 girls in incarceration. So more places are starting to develop these programs and more places are seeing success at getting girls out of the, you know, carceral system.
And one of the things that really surprised me, because on the face of it, if you think of this kind of program where social workers have a handful of people they deal with instead of dozens, you think that might cost more money to whoever, whether it's the county or the state providing that. But just the sheer cost of juvenile incarceration was staggering. Some estimates put it at $100,000 a year. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it is extremely expensive to incarcerate a child. So in most states, it's, you know, around $100,000 a year to lock a kid up. In some states, it's even more expensive than that. In California, it's more like $300,000 a year. So, you know, you're paying for the facilities, you're paying for staff at these facilities. It's just extremely expensive. And it's also not that effective. Kids who are locked up, they're exposed to even more trauma. And a lot of times that then leads to further arrests down the road. Whereas programs like Girls Court or the Young Women's Freedom Center, it's significantly less expensive. The Young Women's Freedom Center might spend like several thousand dollars to help a kid over the course of a year, to connect them with housing and healthcare and things that actually address like their trauma and the root causes. So I think these programs are making communities safer and they're also saving a lot of money.
And then one more thing that struck me in your article was you talked about the history of the juvenile justice system and just the long history of paternalism when it came to both boys and girls. And I kind of wonder, because your article also poses the question of why do we only do this for girls? Why hasn't this model been expanded to all youth to boys too. And do you see that as a continuation of some sort of like paternalism or sexism or something?
That's a great question. I think more so the reason that these programs have started out for girls is because girls are a lot less likely than boys to be incarcerated for violence. And so I think girls are seen as kind of an easier population, even politically, an easier population to work with. There might be more political will to get girls out of the justice system. So I think that is a primary reason why these programs have started out for girls. Girls also are a lot more likely than boys to have experienced prior trauma before getting into the justice system. So I think like 35% of girls who are incarcerated have survived like sexual abuse, even more have survived physical abuse, prior suicide attempts. And so programs that try to help girls work with their trauma and connect them with resources, I think it kind of makes sense. But I think it's really just a first step because programs like these could help, you know, people of all genders, really. Boys in the justice system also have experienced a lot of prior trauma. And in fact, there are some studies that are starting to show that these programs can be very effective for boys, too. Researchers at NYU looked at, you know, dozens of juvenile justice programs, and they found that boys did better in the programs that were designed for traumatized girls than they did in traditional programs designed for boys. Boys even saw more, success in these programs than the girls did. They had greater reductions in delinquency, aggression. So, I mean, really listening to a kid, asking them what's going on in their life, what resources they need, what kind of trauma they've been through, you know, what healing they actually think they need is going to be effective for anyone, I think, you know, whether you're a boy or a girl or any gender.
Lastly, your article ends on almost a question mark of this note of fear or uncertainty, because as some of these programs succeed, including the one in Hawaii, there's the fear that it almost works too well, that people will then forget what it was like before, you know, we diverted incarceration of girls and young people. What are some of the open questions looking toward the future on these programs?
Well, politically, I think there's a question of how much we can expand these programs to other places. There is a lot of fear right now about crime, even though crime levels are actually dropping and they're, you know, going lower than what they were before the pandemic. There's a lot of fear. People don't feel safe. And so there might be some hesitancy to expanding programs that get kids out of incarceration. There's also some questions around funding. The Trump administration is not likely to fund programs like this. So those are some question marks. But yeah, a lot of the juvenile justice system actually is, you know, funded at the local level. So I think there is still possibility for programs like this to expand. But then, yeah, even if we do get girls out of detention, even if we stop incarcerating girls, I think the point is that even that is not the end of the work. There's still more work to do because even if girls aren't in prison, we still need to be providing them with resources on the front end, making sure that they have the resources they need before they get into trouble so that they're not actually getting into trouble. Yeah, getting girls out of prison, I think, is a first step, and then there's a lot more work to do.
That was Samantha Michaels, Mother Jones reporter, talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to the story on our website later today. We have to go now, but up tomorrow we plan to check in with the health department over a concerning rise in whooping cough cases, a vaccine-preventable disease. Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, on Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.